This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and Happy New Year. Today, we are going to devote our show to a new book that takes a fascinating look at the 60-year friendship between two men who played prominent roles in our nation's history of the latter part of the 20th century. The book is called Texas Titans, George H.W. Bush and James A. Baker III, A Friendship Forged in Power. The author is Charles Denyer. He is a vice presidential historian, a national security and cybersecurity expert, and a political and business consultant. He holds a bachelor's degree in history and government and two master's degrees, one in information systems from Johns Hopkins and the other in nuclear engineering. He visits with guest host Rick Collin, a presidential historian and former faculty member at the University of Mary in Bismarck.
Welcome to the program today, Charles.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
In addition to your latest book, you've written a couple of books about the vice presidency. Before we talk about Texas Titans, tell us just a little bit about them and what makes you so interested in this office. It really has grown quite a bit in influence in the last half century or so. Before that, of course, people like Harry Truman, who was number two for FDR for about 80 days, he called it about, quote, as useful as a cow's fifth teat. And then, of course, there's that more famous quote from FDR's first Veep, John Nance Garner, who said the job isn't worth a pitcher of warm spit, only, of course, his actual quote is a little bit spicier than that.
It is. It's quite a bit spicier than that, but we'll leave that alone and maybe pick that up in another conversation. It was an office that I think for many years, decades, almost two centuries, one you consider somewhat insignificant and irrelevant, but that changed dramatically with the election of Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale in the Mondale model. Carter gave Mondale unique and unprecedented access to everything in the Oval Office. Anything that came through Carter's desk, Mondale saw also. And since then, I would argue that precedent has held up in different capacities. Each of the vice presidents since Mondale had taken on different types of roles, some more executive CEO type, such as Gore and Biden, some as true influencers and policymakers, such as Dick Cheney.
And we're going to talk more about this a little bit later in the interview, but of course Bush is Reagan's number two, played a very important role in the Reagan administration years. So.
He did. I think his most important role, more than anything, was his profound loyalty, something that was seen, obviously, in the assassination attempt on his life, March 30th, 1981, Reagan, clinging to life, he could have easily passed his powers on to George Bush at that time. Bush did not want to do that. And also, Bush returned from Texas. He could have easily landed on the South Lawn on Marine Two, made quite a show, if you will, but he decided not to. His famous comment, only the president lands on the South Lawn.
And he never was critical of Alexander Haig's I'm in charge now performance shortly after
shooting. For two reasons. I think, number one, the media has glorified that. If you listen to the entire tape, he says, I am in charge. He also says it's pending return of the vice president.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, a lot of times the media cuts that off. And then secondly, that's not Bush. He understood the gravity of the situation. He also knew how Haig is. Haig is a little rough around the shoulders, if you will. He's a little general, kind of a hard, crusty guy. And so he's not going to give Al a hard time when he arrives at the Situation Room after the assassination attempt.
Let's talk about Texas Titans. What inspired you to write this book, and how did you go about getting your arms around such a huge topic?
Well, I think these two gentlemen are two of the most impactful and consequential statesmen of the last 50 years. If you look at their resumes, look at their accomplishments, they're almost legendary. Because of that, I think there's a wonderful story to be told. Story of political chess playing and how much power they had, but also a story of incredible friendship, one that started on the tennis courts of the Houston Country Club decades ago. They did not know each other, both Baker and Bush. They were paired with one another as doubles partners. They won back-to-back champions. And ironically, that type of relationship and how they were better together than they were apart also spilled over into the political arena. They really, truly understood each other's roles. They complemented each other tremendously. and were able to rise all the way to the top of the White House. Really a remarkable story of a political and personal friendship forged in power, as is the tagline.
And you mentioned how they met, and Baker actually had several nicknames for Bush over the years.
He did. And when he would call him everything from, you know, Veep to Big Brother to Hefe, it truly was, I would say, a big brother, little brother relationship. And as I tell people many times, the conversation that I've had with Baker, he would tell me, well, you know, the president and I, or the vice president and I, whichever position he was holding at that time, we would have very spirited conversations. He would turn to me and say, Jim, if you're so smart, why am I vice president? Or, Jim, if you're so smart, why am I president? Obviously in a joking way, but to have that type of friendship and to have a spirited conversation, to jab each other that way, I think speaks to just how close they really were and how much respect they had for each other.
Give us a little background about the early years of both Bush and Baker, you know, where they were born, a little bit of the family background, their early careers before they met.
You know, Baker, first and foremost, is a multi-generational Texan. He's about as blue blood as a Texan can be. His family really helped create what's modern-day Houston. He's a Houstonian through and through, and he would be the first to tell you there's no other city he'd rather live. The city of Houston loves Jim Baker, and likewise, Jim loves Houston. Now, for Bush, and this is really a testament to Texas where I'm going with this comment, he obviously, you know, was born and raised in the East Coast, but he did move to Texas, moved out to West Texas, and ultimately made his way to Houston, where his political career took off. And Houstonians will be the first to tell you, too, they embrace him just as much as they embrace, you know, Jim Baker as one of theirs. Being a Texan is not a birthright, it's an attitude. And I think Bush's attitude played very well into the Texan ideology. Dream big, work hard, be that friendly, outgoing, gregarious type of personality that Bush was at times. That's the Texan for you. There, you know, there's a whole discussion in Texas that's called the Texanhood of George Bush, and how really over the decades he transformed himself from an East Coast guy where barbecue and cowboy boots were very foreign to him when he came to Texas. But by the time he settled into Houston, he was very comfortable with that.
Now, Baker entered the political arena after Bush asked him to manage his 1970 race for the U.S. Senate. I think Bush had run, well, he was a congressman at that time, right? He had, and then he ran in 1970 for the Senate. Nixon, President Nixon, had urged him to do that.
And correct. Nixon asked him to not run again for Congress, but right, to run for the Senate seat. And he went to Jim and said, Jim, I'd like your help. And Jim said, that's great, but you know, two things about me. Number one, I'm a Democrat. Number two, I don't know much about politics. And George Bush said, I can change both of those.
And how did that 70 race turn out for Bush?
Well, he lost, but if you think about that, in losing, he really gained by losing. He gained his closest political ally for the next quarter century, a man that would help him become a two-term vice president and also the president. And in return, Baker became chief of staff, secretary of the treasury, secretary of state, then chief of staff once again, all while running five successive presidential campaigns from 1976 to 1992. Mm-hmm. So really these two men, in a way, helped transform the entire Republican Party for a generation. That's how significant they were to the Republican Party. And then obviously Bush's single term in office, which we can talk about later, those events were simply just cataclysmic, if you will, and the ramifications on the world stage were just unprecedented.
Getting a little bit more on the 1970 Senate race, you have an interesting story in the book about Bush approaching then-former President Lyndon Johnson for advice on whether he should run for the Senate. That's interesting. Johnson's response was typical, LBJ colorful, that the difference between being a senator and a congressman is the difference between chicken salad and chicken, fill in the blank.
LBJ.
LBJ, the one and only. But you also note that Bush asked Johnson for his advice also after Nixon appointed him UN ambassador shortly after he lost that Senate race to Lloyd Benson. I find it really interesting that Bush sought Johnson out for advice, especially since they were in opposing political parties. And actually, that's refreshing to read that.
And on multiple occasions, really one of the stories that comes out of this book is the relationship that former President Bush had with former President Lyndon Baines Johnson early in their careers. Now, Johnson is obviously done. He's retired. He's moving out of office. You know, he was pushed out, if you will. That's a whole other story. But, yes, he did. He did reach out to former President Johnson on a number of occasions asking him for his advice, and Johnson was happy to give to him.
As only Johnson could.
Sure, yeah, Texan straight talk, if you will.
Exactly. So did Baker himself ever run for office?
He ran once. He ran in 1978, and he lost. He ran for attorney general. He ran against a gentleman named Mark White, who became governor of Texas from, I believe, 82 to 86 was Clements' term, or White's term, and he lost to Bill Clements in 86. But he'll be the first to tell you, when I would see Mark White, I would thank him for defeating me, because look at this wonderful career I had as a result of that.
You mentioned, too, of course, the sterling resume of George H.W. Bush, as well as Baker, and Baker's credentials. You mentioned he was Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of State. Did he ever consider running for president?
Briefly. He thought about it in 1996. I spoke to him about that. But by that time, he was tired. He had accomplished so much in his career. He had high name recognition, high favorability. I think he just wanted to spend time with his wife, Susan, and his kids. You know, he'd just been on the road and been so involved in politics for so many years. You know, it's interesting. We give titles to people. When you think of George Bush, you say, oh, well, yeah, he's a former president. Well, he is, but he's much more than that. Special envoy to China, director of the CIA, congressman, 41st vice president of the United States. I mean, when you go to Baker, you get different answers. Oh, yeah, he was Secretary of State, or, oh, he was Chief of Staff, or wasn't he the Treasury guy? And it's a little harder to define and give Baker a single title. That's because he did so many things. But I look at Baker in all those roles, but also the campaign gunslinger who ran five successive presidential campaigns, held these incredible posts of power, if you will, Chief of Staff, Secretary of Treasury, and Secretary of State. But after office in 2000, he's called upon by Bush to help with the Bush-Gore debacle in Florida. He also helps his best friend's son become the President of the United States. So time and time again, from 1975 to when he shows up in Washington as the Undersecretary of Commerce, all the way to 2001, this quarter-century period, he is knee-deep into everything in Washington.
And let's talk, you mentioned that 2000 election. Let's just jump forward a little bit in terms of chronology here. As you mentioned, he was put in charge of the political dogfight in Florida to secure those 25 electoral votes, and the presidency was ultimately decided in the U.S. Supreme Court 5 weeks after Election Day. In charge of Gore's efforts was President Clinton's former Secretary of State, Warren Christopher, who was actually a North Dakota native, born in Scranton in 1925. He's 5 years older than Baker. And you write this about the two men in your book, quote, on paper, both Baker and Christopher were former Secretary of State, but that's about all they had in common. Christopher was a corporate litigator, virtually no campaign experience. Baker, on the other hand, was the unquestioned GOP operative of his generation, a tough-talking Texan, ready to engage in a political dogfight. Their personalities differed greatly also. Christopher was prudent, almost to the point of tentative. Baker was dogged, partisan, and ferocious if necessary. And in his foreword to your book, former Vice President Dick Cheney says that Baker, quote, outworked and outmaneuvered Gore's campaign with a brilliant display of political acumen.
Agreed. And I think if you really, one of the worst decisions Al Gore made, he made two bad decisions. Number one was cherry-picking four counties to do a recount on, which he did. He should have probably asked for a full recount in all of them. And then number two, picking Christopher, who was really walking into a dogfight. I mean, this is almost a chihuahua against a Doberman. Baker, again, is dogged. He's partisan. He is ready for a brawl. He knows what's going on. Christopher is a little more genteel. He's hoping this can be settled in a gentlemanly way. And his real thought was that during a recount, it would show that Gore was going to be the winner. And when that didn't happen, recount after recount, he really didn't have too many avenues. He had some good political wins early, but that's because the Democratic Supreme Court, the Supreme Court in Florida, I think was heavily Democratic at that time. But he was outworked. He was really outclassed, if you will. This was not his domain or his territory. And I really did not think that was a wise choice by Gore. He was just too tentative. And Baker exploited that fully. Baker knew when this happened, right before he even touched down in Tallahassee, he told some of the top brass in the GOP, especially Cheney and Bush, this is going to the Supreme Court. You have to get it the hell out of Florida and get it into the Supreme Court. That's the only way we're going to win this.
You're listening to a conversation between presidential historian Rick Collin and Charles Denyer, the author of Texas Titans, George H.W. Bush and James A. Baker III, A Friendship Forged in Power. Coming up after this break, they discuss the important role of former Vice President Dick Cheney in the relationship and his contributions to the book.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we wish you all a Happy New Year and we take a look back at the year 2020.
As the Grateful Dead told us, what a long, strange trip it's been. The most disruptive year of the 21st century. One of the most disruptive years in American history.
We take a listen to some of our favorite conversations with President Jefferson and many of our special guests.
As always, we try to see the world through the enlightened eyes of the third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson.
Jefferson shares his views on pandemics, talking about the yellow fever epidemic of 1793, and listeners share their views.
Plus, we had four memorable weeks of conversation about the correspondence between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson during their retirements, all with Dr. Joseph Ellis.
Please join us for all that and more as we look back on the year 2020 on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today we are airing a conversation with author Charles Denyer, who wrote the book Texas Titans, George H.W. Bush and James A. Baker III, A Friendship Forged in Power. He visits with Rick Collin, a presidential historian.
Charles, Dick Cheney, we mentioned him briefly just a minute ago. He played an important role, during the Bush-Baker years, serving as Bush's Secretary of Defense and, of course, vice president during son George W. Bush's presidency. And he also, as I mentioned, has written the foreword to your book. Tell us how that came about and what he has to say about Bush and Baker.
Sure. Well, Cheney, if you think about some of the true power players in Washington over the last half century, Dick Cheney may reign supreme above them all. Youngest chief of staff ever to a president of the United States at 34 years old, Gerald Ford. Elected six times to Congress, served five terms, and then became Secretary of Defense and a two-term vice president. What a lot of people don't know, he's very close to Jim Baker. They've been very good personal friends. Cheney actually brought Baker over from the Commerce Department in 1975 to get involved in President Ford's reelection campaign. He was a delegate counter trying to fend off Reagan. He did a phenomenal job. Cheney saw that very quickly, along with the other top brass in the Republican Party. That really took Baker's career to new heights. So Cheney was very instrumental in seeing talent. I think that's one of Cheney's probably best traits and where they can best help advance a cause or a policy directive. The relationship, obviously he was Secretary of Defense, a very, very much admired Secretary of Defense, and did an incredible job over the Gulf War. Look, all these men worked together well during the single term for Bush. The national security team that was put together, the president, Baker, Scowcroft, Cheney, Powell, Vice President Quayle at times, probably the best national security team that's ever been put in place in recent memory. And they each understood each other's turf. They respected each other. And to this day, Dick Cheney and James Baker have been very good friends. They fish regularly. They hunt together regularly. A lot of people don't know that.
Are they still active? Of course, Baker turned 90, I believe, earlier this year. How active is he?
Secretary Baker is quite active. I mean, I met with him a number of occasions over the last few months. We had a 4 or 5 hour sit down. It was kind of a post wrap up on this book. He really looks like he's probably 71, not about to be 91. It's amazing the strength and stamina this man has. I think he has many years to go. Dick Cheney, I think I always tell the vice president he's got more than nine lives. You know, he's working with a heart transplant. He's staying busy also. Obviously, he was very busy before COVID on the lecture tour, doing a lot of other things that local heavyweights get to do. But I think they're examples of how they look forward and they don't look to the past. I mean, I showed up at Baker's office about a month ago in Rice University in Houston, about to be 91, looks like he's 71. Full suit on, ready to discuss, ready to talk about the book in a very businesslike manner. It's very impressive. It really is.
That's terrific. That's good to hear. You talk about Baker and Cheney. When Baker was named by Reagan as his chief of staff, he went to Cheney for advice on how to handle that incredibly complicated job because Cheney had been, 34-year-old chief of staff for President Gerald Ford.
Yeah, and that's a testament to Baker on two fronts. Number one, to reach out to individuals who had served in that role prior to really get their read and a pulse on how to do the job. But also reaching out to one of his good friends who I think did an amazing job as chief of staff to President Ford. So once again, you see these men, they have the ability to leverage their relationships in the most meaningful way, both personally and politically, to understand the challenges that are ahead for them. For Baker, he's about to become Reagan's chief of staff. What better person to go to speak about the upcoming role than one of your good friends, Dick Cheney, who served in that role. And I would argue a very contentious time because this is post-Watergate. And you've got Congress really just hounding down on the presidency. I think Cheney had a tough job as chief of staff, you know, with the endless inquiries and congressional hearings that Congress pushed on the Ford administration. But obviously, he handled it very admirably.
And, you know, I think it says a tremendous amount about Baker's character and his political skills that even though he had served as Ford's chief delegate hunter in that 1976 GOP fight against Ronald Reagan, and he also managed Bush's failed 1980 presidential campaign against Reagan that the Gipper turned around after the election and asked Baker to be his chief of staff. You quote Baker in your book as saying, quote, "I don't think it's going to happen again in American politics where a president-elect will ask the campaign manager of two opponents of his to be his White House chief of staff."
Well, and that's a testament to Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, Baker tried to take Reagan out, not once, but twice. Okay, 76 in the primaries against Ford, and then 80 in the primaries with Bush. But Reagan was such a bigger person in terms of understanding what was needed in his administration, what was good for the country. One of his close operatives, Stu Spencer at the time, you know, he told Stu, "Look, this is the kind of guy I'd like to have on my side." And Steve said, "Well, you know what? I'm going to put you and Baker together on a plane ride. And you guys just talk. You don't know each other, but just talk." And this is when Reagan at that time had secured the nomination or was close to it. And he found a lot of things to like about James Baker.
And during Bush's 4 years as president, the world, of course, as you explained very well in your book, underwent a series of enormous historic events. We're talking the Tiananmen Square massacre, where hundreds of innocent demonstrators were slaughtered in communist China, the U.S. invasion of Panama, the overthrow of Manuel Noriega, the fall of the Berlin Wall, reunification of the two Germanies, of course, the Persian Gulf War, and the expelling of Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein from Kuwait, the collapse of the Soviet Union and its communist empire in Eastern Europe. These are all incredibly seminal events, and they all took place on the Bush-Baker watch. And as they unfolded, Bush turned to his trusted friend again and again, Secretary of State Baker, to meet the challenges they presented. Give us a couple of examples of how these two men worked together during these enormous events.
Well, if you listen to what you just said, isn't it amazing? It's almost unprecedented, the series of events that folded out on the international arena. I mean, who could have predicted those type of events? It all happened in really about a 42, 43-month period. Just unreal. So one man can't do it all. The president is just a president. Though he had incredible and well-competent and capable national security team, his trusted advisor is Baker, time and time again. Baker is the one that is globetrotting to build the coalition. Baker is the one who went to the Soviet Union to visit with Mikhail Gorbachev. Baker is the one who built the personal relationship with Edward Shevardnadze. But of course, he was allowed to do these things because he had the complete support of his president. And he has told me once before sort of how close his relationship was with George Bush. It was simply as if no one got between me and my president. So if you think about that statement, to have that type of trust, to have that type of respect, relationship personally, politically, with each other, it's a big reason why the United States was so successful in the international arena during those very consequential events that unfolded. I mean, that really is, that's an amazing statement. No one gets between me and my president. How many secretaries of state can really say that?
That's right. We've seen so many controversial secretaries of states over the years who resigned or got caught up in political turf fights with other cabinet members, and this was more the exception than the rule, that's for sure.
It was, and here's something ironic in today's political arena. Trump is notorious for expelling people left and right within days, weeks, and months of his administration. But he does have a true affinity and respect for Pompeo. They are really tight. And if you think about it, that's one gentleman that he has never publicly criticized.
That's a good point. Those two have stayed the course, and Pompeo.
They have.
Especially when you look at the first Secretary of State and what happened to him after not too many months on the job. So.
No, I think it was 3 or 4 months, and I think he called Trump a moron, and that was it.
You know, let's talk a little bit about the 1992 presidential campaign. Baker, just as he resigned as Reagan Secretary of the Treasury to run Bush's campaign in 88, he then resigned as Bush's Secretary of State to run his campaign for reelection in 92. Of course, Bush lost that in a three-way race with the Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton, Democratic nominee, and then the billionaire businessman Ross Perot. But contrary to what many believe, Baker says it wasn't because Bush broke his no new taxes pledge. Baker says there were other reasons he lost.
And nothing to do with no new taxes. By the time the electorate are going to the polls in 1992, they don't ever remember that. Two words, Ross Perot. He took 19.5% of the vote. The vast majority of those votes, upwards of two-thirds of them, were definitely going to be Republican votes for Bush. Those were Republican and moderate Republican defectors or independents or conservative Democrats that voted for Perot as a rebellion vote, if you will. So, no doubt about it, he cost George Bush the election. And that was done out of personal animosity. Did not like George Bush, did not like George Bush's family. Perot thought he was the real Texan, not this gentleman who came from the East Coast.
And when you were visiting with Baker about the book, were there any particular insights that he had that struck you or you found, I hadn't really thought about that, or this was particularly a revelation?
No, Jim is pretty consistent on his delivery in terms of the subject matter that we speak about and what his thoughts are. But what he did echo, what I just spoke about, that there was a true animus, if you will, from Ross Perot against Bush. He did not like the fact, he had this beautiful home in Kennebunkport. He had a little bit of an East Coast vernacular. Perot was shopped at the Men's Warehouse, bought his own suits, drove his own car. He could have easily, purchased the Bush family maybe 10 times over, but it wasn't about that. So there are things that just rubbed him wrong. And of course, the biggest is President Reagan told Vice President Bush, when Bush was vice president, you need to call Perot back in Texas and tell him we're done looking for POWs. Well, that really rubbed Ross wrong.
And that was something that you mentioned in the book, that Perot never forgave Reagan, and of course Bush, being Reagan's vice president, he added that to the other animosities he had against Bush.
He shot the messenger.
Mm-hmm. We're running out of time here, Charles. But just another quick question: you have visited with Baker, of course. Are you putting your book together? What's his reaction to your book? One of the chapters I like particularly in your book is called Around the World with James A. Baker. And you include excerpts of speeches and articles that he's written over the years that talk about his take on the state of the world.
Yeah, I think that was interesting because to nail down Jim's thoughts on all of these topics would have taken quite some time. So I told him, I said, you know, there's so much information about you out there. Obviously, information you've been put out in an op-ed or speech or seminar, I'm going to run with that because it's really, I think, a good representation of your thoughts. And I think what I found in putting that section together, and hopefully you found in reading it, is how well-versed he is on the global arena. And every one of his comments in that Around the World chapter, it comes with this real thoughtful analysis and his strategy for what he thinks is going to happen next. And I find that just very interesting. You know, when President Obama was elected, when he was president-elect, he went down to see Jim Baker. And Jim Baker gave him the around-the-world tour in terms of the hot spots, what you need to be aware of. That's pretty significant when a Democratic president seeks out an old guard from the Republican Party to give him a tour around the world.
It reminds me a little bit of Nixon when he was a former president and presidents coming in would reach out to tap his foreign policy expertise.
Oh, sure. They all did that. Mm-hmm. I do remember on a number of occasions Nixon being involved with president-elects and vice president-elects also.
You're listening to a conversation between historians Rick Collin and Charles Denyer about a book exploring the friendship between George H.W. Bush and James A. Baker. Coming up after this break, we hear more about Baker's political skill, smooth and respectful presidential transitions, and their enduring legacies.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
Governor Doug Burgum gives his State of the State address Tuesday, January 5th, to a joint session of the North Dakota Legislature. Prairie Public will provide live coverage of the speech, and we'll have reaction from lawmakers. So tune in Tuesday at 1:30 p.m. Central Time for the State of the State Address, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today guest host Rick Collin, a presidential historian, is talking with author Charles Denyer, who wrote the book Texas Titans, George H.W. Bush and James A. Baker III, A Friendship Forged in Power.
A couple of final quick questions. Bush died, of course, 2 years ago. Were you able to visit with him at all about when you're putting this book together and material?
I was not, unfortunately. We had traded letters prior to his passing. I'd sent him books before. He and Barbara, a number of occasions, written me letters of thanks and congratulations on the books, and always with some funny stories in them.
Do you have another book or other writing projects in the works?
I do. I'm the personal biographer to former Vice President Dick Cheney. That'll be out in the fall of 2021. That will be Cheney's tell-all biography, so I'm excited about that. And in between then, I have a book called Blindsided. Speaks about today's growing cybersecurity attacks against America's economic system and the need to protect organizations. So we've got two books in the works. That'll be my fifth book in 4 years, and it'll be time to take a break.
Sounds like another couple of good radio interview programs down the pipeline a little bit as well.
Well, I hope so.
Well, let's go back to that 1976 campaign, because I find that very interesting. That's where Baker really kind of became known for the first time as this masterful political operator. The media in the 1976 presidential campaign dubbed him the Miracle Man. He was President Ford's chief delegate hunter that year, and that was a tough job. He lined up enough delegates for Ford to be able to barely beat out Reagan for the nomination, but it really helped establish Baker's credentials as this masterful political operator and diplomat.
Correct. And what makes, I think, the story even more significant and compelling is a year before that, he essentially is just about to leave Houston as a practicing lawyer to go become Undersecretary of Commerce. So it's one thing that he had this position as delegate hunter. He had 10, 20, 30 years of experience in the Washington arena. He didn't. He was a freshman, if you will. He was fresh out of Texas and probably barely knew his way around the federal buildings. Next thing you know, not only is he a delegate hunter, but Ford was so impressed that he ends up becoming the actual head honcho, if you will, running the entire election for the president of the United States. So the delegate hunter is where he made his mark. Jack Stiles was a delegate hunter who died in a car accident. And Baker was given the task of that job and performed incredibly well. I made a comment in the opening of my remarks, the author remarks, if someone had to close to get a delegate, we'd bring Jim in. So maybe he had a little bit of that, you know, Texan attitude of not giving up. That also made him so effective as a delegate hunter. All these politicians have those single moments that either create that opening for them in their political life, or that moment where, you know, they've been elected and really something that wasn't expected, such as Bill Clinton in 1992 or Carter in 76. For Baker, it's the delegate hunter position. For Cheney, it's the chief of staff position. I mean, they all had those moments where those little windows gave them that true opening.
The 1980 presidential campaign, pivotal, of course, for both Bush and Baker. Reagan chose Bush to be his running mate to oppose Jimmy Carter's bid for re-election. You write in your book, and this is a quote, reflecting back on the night Reagan offered Bush the number two spot, Baker recalled, quote, if he hadn't gotten that call, he has said, and I firmly believe there would not have been a Bush 41. And if there had not been a Bush 41, Bush 43 has said there wouldn't have been a Bush 43. And I believe that, too.
So that phone call was probably one of the most significant phone calls in modern times for the Republican Party, because what that effectively did was it gave birth to the Bush dynasty. With Bush saying yes, what happens after that? You have George Herbert Walker Bush, a two-term vice president, one-term president. You have George W. Bush, elected twice as governor of Florida, a two-term president. You have Jeb Bush, a two-term governor of Florida. Now imagine, all of that was really an indirect result of that phone call.
And then I want to step back just a little bit again, that 1970 Senate race where Bush and Baker really began working politically for the first time. There's quite a backstory to that, and that was that Baker's wife had died of cancer, and Bush was doing what he could as a good friend to help Baker through that terrible time in his life, and he thought one way might be to get him involved in the political arena. Take his mind off that a little bit.
That's correct. That was a really devastating time for Jim. Wife died of breast cancer, and they kept most of that private until the very bitter end. And I believe George and Barbara Bush were perhaps two of the last people to ever see Mary Stuart, who was Jim Baker's first wife, before she slipped into a coma and passed away. So, you know, it's such a horrible, horrible event in his life for Jim Baker. He had the full support of his good friend, George Bush, right by his side. So that even strengthened their relationship to, I think, an unbelievable height, unbelievable level, if you will, after that. So anything that those two gentlemen wanted to accomplish, if they had each other's backs, I think they were going to go after it, and it proved to be quite successful.
And right up, as you mentioned earlier, right up to the end, those two men were very close. Bush, as I mentioned earlier, died 2 years ago on November 30th. And Baker saw him that morning in the hospital.
He did, actually, in his home. He went over to his home and just outside of Tanglewood.
He was at home then, not the hospital.
He was. He was okay. At home. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was at home. And I think West Oaks is a neighborhood just outside of Tanglewood in Houston. Bush said, where are we going today? And Baker said, we're going to heaven, Hefe. And Bush said, great, let's go, something to that effect. I think he knew it was his time.
And Hefe is Spanish for?
The boss.
The boss.
So he always called him in later years Jefe.
Jim Baker, still, as you said, very active, vigorous man. He works out every day. He goes for walks. You mentioned that in your book. How does he feel about the state of the current national political scene? Have you had a chance to ask him about that recently?
I have. We've spoken about it. And obviously, compromise is now a dirty word. And in the old days, it's how you got things done. The left has gotten lefter, the right has gotten righter, and the middle has gotten even slimmer. So compromise is going to become even more difficult in the years ahead. And that's one thing that he and I agreed on, is both sides have hardened. We have an electorate now that is either very left or very right, and there's not much left in the center. So he thinks there's going to be some big challenges ahead.
Now we're in the midst of another presidential transition. From Biden, rather from Trump to the Biden administration. How did President Bush handle his administration's transition with the incoming Bill Clinton administration? That was not easy for him either.
No, but he handled it with humility and grace. He knew that the electorate had spoken. I think one of the things he said in his concession speech, the majesty of this system is the people have spoken and they have chosen their new leader, and it's time for us to respect that and to move on. And they did just that. The transition was very seamless and very smooth and very efficient, void of any type of issues, I would say. Much like, you know, Clinton to George W. Bush. There are a few funny things, you know. They would remove the W from the keyboards on the computer. Yeah, a few people play little funny games, but overall, it was fine. This transition is underway right now between Biden and Trump. It's a little slow because they're behind the eight ball. They have a limited amount of time.
But keep this in perspective also, though, that Bush-Gore 2000 race, it wasn't decided by the Supreme Court until December 12th.
And that's correct.
They made that transition. So this is not unprecedented.
No, and they made that transition, and a big reason why they made that transition successful was because Dick Cheney ran the transition while Bush was in Austin. He did a masterful job at running that transition. What's interesting is while Bush and Gore were fighting it out, Cheney is in his townhome in McLean, Virginia, as, you know, what do you call him? Vice President-elect? No, Vice President-elect designate? I don't know. We don't know what it is, but he took the notion that they were going to win and we're going to go ahead and plan the transition for the new administration.
Now, when Bush left office in January of 93, this is a tradition among outgoing presidents to leave a note behind for their successor. And Bush left a particularly memorable note behind for Clinton in the Oval Office.
He did. And I think the very last line was very memorable. I'm rooting for you. And that speaks to how the president rose above partisan politics and put the nation first and not his feelings first. The loss was devastating to George Herbert Walker Bush. He lost to a man who was a younger generation, a man who, at times during the campaign, Bush would question his character and who he was as a person to be president. But regardless, he was the president, and Bush was going to fully respect that.
And after that loss in 92, of course, Bush had another 26 very productive years left in his life. And that included his growing friendship with Bill Clinton, who they became pretty good friends.
They did. They became good friends, Bill Clinton. And I think George Bush both agreed on this idea that Bush was the father that Bill Clinton never had.
And speaking of how active Bush remained that last quarter century of his life post-presidency, he would jump out of airplanes, he'd parachute to certain landmark birthdays.
He did. I think he did on his 75th, 80, 85, 90, like to parachute. Think about this. He was a naval aviator, so regardless of his age, I'm safe to assume he had no fear of heights.
And he, of course, he was hoping to be around to do his 95th, and he didn't. He died, of course, at the age of 94, but he was talking about doing that even in his early 90s. Remarkable.
Pretty amazing. A testament to a man who just kept moving forward and conquering new challenges.
One of the other I found particularly interesting chapters in your book is the last chapter. You feature recollections about Bush and Baker by a wide variety of public figures. And again, everybody from Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, to Mikhail Gorbachev, all remembering the immense contributions these two men made.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because if you look at the leaders of our country the past 40, 50 years, you may have a hard time finding consensus all across the world from such a wide range of people that say very similar things, men of integrity. But you get that when you ask people about James A. Baker and George Herbert Walker Bush. And again, that's just more of an underscore of how important these two figures were.
And Baker, final point as we finish our conversation today, he established the Baker Institute for Public Policy back in the early 90s. And this is another example of how influential and impactful his career was as Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of State, Chief of Staff to two presidents. Four former presidents attended that groundbreaking event in 1994, Ford, Carter, Reagan, and Bush.
They did, and that's a testament to how this foundation has become one of the bluest of the blue chips of these think tanks. The amount of money that has been raised by the Baker Institute in such a short period of time has been phenomenal. Again, that's a testament to who Jim Baker is. He can bring in the biggest and the best of world names for events, for fundraisers, for speaking opportunities. And from Yasser Arafat to former presidents, almost anybody that's anybody in the world of politics over the last 50 years, if they're still alive or they were alive then when it was founded, have made their way through the halls of the Baker Institute.
Charles, it looks like we are about out of time. I want to thank you. This has been a very interesting conversation, a real pleasure visiting with you today about your new book.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it very much.
I'd like to thank my guest, author Charles Denyer, who has written a fascinating and information-packed new book about two of the most important figures in the history of the late 20th century, Texas Titans, George H.W. Bush and James A. Baker III, A Friendship Forged in Power. And also thanks to all of you Prairie Public Radio listeners for joining us today.
That was guest host Rick Collin, a presidential historian and former faculty member at the University of Mary. Dakota Datebook is next.
Well, hello there. I'm Tom Brusso. On the first Great American Folk Show in 2021, a remarkable lineup of extraordinary artists, starting with the meditative, otherworldly sound of Kyle Field and his band Little Wings.
Now I know you probably think I should have told you everything and explained every thought that I was thinking today, this morning, this evening.
The distinctly Southern California anti-folk music of Mr. Herman Doom.
I used to dream of the LBC, watching Snoop Dogg on the MTV. And now I miss my youth and I miss my tooth, but I'm cruising and sipping on gin and juice.
Plus, musician, podcast host, and self-described accidental rancher, Eliza Blue.
There's a song without words that goes.
We'll hear from musician Elisa Flynn and introducing Ray Zaragoza.
Take me like a debutante, your prom queen. Pretty little lit girl, yeah, that's me.
Enjoy lots of exceptional music and painter Molly Douthat on the Great American Folk Show. That's Sunday, January 3rd at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 1st. Not everybody went along with mandates meant to curb the 1918 flu pandemic. Bismarck had a mask mandate for waitresses and others handling food. The city health officer announced the order would be strictly enforced. waitresses of at least one dining establishment declined, leading authorities to take steps to see that they comply or are prevented from serving food. Masks could be obtained for no charge from Bismarck's city health officer or the Red Cross. Newspapers carried instructions for making masks from gauze. Bismarck police had orders to arrest and jail anyone loitering or congregating on streets. The chief of police put a corps of extra officers on duty for enforcement. Perhaps one of the most dramatic events in defiance was a New Year's Eve dance at the Odd Fellows Hall in Botno that wrapped up in the early hours of January 1, 1919. Days before the dance, Botno County's Board of Health had adopted strict rules aimed at preventing the influenza's spread. Among the restrictions, all public dances. Invitations to the dance spread by word of mouth. Young people and, quote, brave expounders of personal liberty, unquote, held and attended the dance. High school students stopped by the hall to look on. The nearby Willow City Eagle newspaper called the dance a mistake that imperiled the health and well-being of a whole community. The paper also reported on questions of what authority the Board of Health had to enforce its rules. It wasn't clear whether the county rules applied to the city. An attorney who served on Botno County's Board of Health said the penalties for violation of the rules were as steep as a $100 fine, 30 days in jail, or both. The board had enacted the strict rules in an effort to, quote, keep the schools of the county open for the remainder of the school year, even though some people may suffer a little by the curtailment of their pleasures or their revenues, unquote. No arrests were made at the dance or in days afterward, and it's unclear if anyone was ever penalized. Locals continued holding dances in January, and several families fell ill after dances in nearby Omimi. The Willow City Eagle newspaper opined that the young people of Botno County should realize that the health and welfare of a community takes precedence over their own personal pleasures, likes or dislikes, or even their own personal liberties. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota. That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, 2020 had major implications for everyone, and we'll hear from Kirsten Baszler, the Superintendent of Public Instruction for the state of North Dakota, to get a recap on how educators and policymakers coped. That's coming up Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend, and Happy New Year.